Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Coming up on today's program, we've got Culture Couch, Dayton Youth Radio, Veterans Voices, and our last edition of Reentry Stories, all produced in the new Eichelberger Center for Community Voices at WISO. We've also got some analysis on the pending sale of Cox Media Group. Later in the program, up first, Reentry Stories is a series on WISO that features conversations between people who were once in prison. More than 1,500 people return to life outside prison in Montgomery County every year. And like returned citizens all over the state, they often have trouble finding jobs, housing, education, and mental health services. All the people heard in Reentry Stories were part of Sinclair Community College's prison training program known as Advanced Job Training, or they've joined the Dayton Collaboratory's X Factor Initiative for returning citizens. Today we meet Letitia Ellis and James Clay. Letitia went to prison right after high school and participated in the Sinclair program, which helped her discover her passion for poetry. James went to prison much later in life and honed a passion for public speaking by ministering to other incarcerated men. He continues to do this as a mentor at the Dayton Collaboratory's X Factor Initiative. First, we hear from Letitia.
When I got incarcerated, it was just after I graduated high school. So I hadn't even reached a certain maturity yet for my brain to grow to be even know who I was as a person. So when I went to prison, 6 years in there, I went from being 20 years old to 27. The person that Letitia could have been after high school and what would I've done, I don't know who she is because prison happened. What was that like for you, your identity?
Very different than yours. I was 40 years old when I went to prison, already being well-established, knowing who I am. I had 7 children. I was coaching. I was lifting. I was a Marine. So I had all these strong attributes, and to go to prison at 40, when I walked into one of the dorms in Chillicothe, there were guys there that I had known that went to prison.
I didn't have that type of lifestyle before prison. You know what I mean? Like I said, I was in high school, but I just realized, like, prison is meant to break you down. They did it. They did it. They did it in their own way because, once again, I was just this kid. So they broke me. They did. But it was up to me to figure out, how do I want to be rebuilt? So how do I let myself not become bitter and angry and mad at the system, make myself shine through this? I find out I could write poetry, and turns out I'm okay with it. Turns out I'm all right. I know you've done a lot of speaking. I was wondering, could you elaborate on that, especially since you've done a lot of work since you got out?
My gift and talent is words. Being a part of the Horizon Prison Initiative, I got an opportunity to interact with over 500 men through this program, and we lived together. So every year was like, I was like a counselor, or we were called encouragers, and you lived with these guys, and then they would graduate, and then another whole new set would come in, and you would learn their issues, and it wasn't me helping them, it was us helping each other, because those 500 plus men prepared me for walking out here on the street.
We have to tell somebody. It's like coming out in the 1800s as a gay person. I'm a felon. Because if you don't tell them, you're a bad person.
Look how many people have went to prison and came back and started businesses and are great citizens and they're great community activists and they're doing all these wonderful things. Don't we like that story that this person came from nothing? They had it all and they lost everything. Ain't that what life's about?
That was Returned Citizens, James Clay and Letitia Ellis. Reentry Stories is produced by Mary Evans, and it's a collaboration between WISO, Sinclair Community College, and the Dayton Collaboratory. Funding support comes from Sinclair and the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices. To hear an extended version of this interview, subscribe to the Reentry Stories podcast at WISO.org or on your favorite podcasting app. Becoming a pilot in the United States Air Force is a long, challenging, and very competitive pursuit. Those who earn their wings are among the elite in the armed services. Today on Veterans Voices, Air Force veteran Fred Abrams of Springboro tells his daughter and grandson about his lifelong passion for flight.
So, Dad, how would you summarize your military service in a couple sentences?
I spent 27 years in the Air Force, became a second lieutenant through ROTC in college while getting a degree in mathematics, and I spent about a third of that 27 flying fighter-type aircraft, including the F-100, the F-4, the F-15, and T-38 supersonic trainer, which was my final flying job.
Awesome. At what point did you decide, yeah, this is it, I want to fly planes for a living?
Well, in college, went up in a light plane, and I says, wow, they can pay me money to do this. And I realized that not only would it be flying airplanes, but I'd be able to fly fast and low. And that was my first real passion, discovering flying.
How did Grandma take the news?
Not well. Total disbelief. And the family was also scared because in 65, Vietnam was building up and it was likely that I would end up in combat.
I remember the stories of Grandma. You sent her pictures of your bullet-ridden plane.
Oh, yes. not thinking. I also sent recordings of rockets and mortars impacting around us while we were in the bunker.
Poor Grandma. When you were in Vietnam, what was happening in the war at that point? What year was it?
I arrived in early January 1968 and got combat ready and started flying missions. And, of course, January 31st, 68 was the beginning of the Tet Offensive, but we were flying very intensively, up to three missions a day.
I'm going to hand this next question to Evan because he loves your war stories. So,
do you have any special war stories to tell?
March 13th, 68, maybe one of the most significant days of my entire life, in that we were putting in an attack for troops in contact, and a 50 caliber sight opened up on the two of us, firing tracers. And my the other aircraft, my lead, a good friend named Obi, saw where they were coming from, rolled in on them, and took three hits. And at that point, I saw where they were coming from, and I rolled in face-to-face with a 50 caliber sight, and he stopped firing. He lost. I won. The reason it was so significant is when the 50 caliber sight opened up on me, I fully expected to die. And I saw in the next few seconds, I'm going to be dead. And I pushed over, and the bullets went across the top of my canopy, and I survived. And that then led to a face-to-face shootout with the guy who was trying to kill me. 50 years of bonus life in 68, over 50 years now.
What were the biggest life lessons you learned from your time in the Air Force?
Most of all that came from the fighter flying is to remain calm and analytical in all stressful situations, including those, as a World War II buddy of mine said, where someone is not shooting at you. But
good old Pops.
Always being calm and analytical, regardless of how stressful, because you make better decisions when you're not stressed.
What are the biggest lessons learned after your military service?
Thoreau was right when he said how tragic it would be to come to the end of one's life and discover that one had never really lived. And Helen Keller was right when she said that life is either an adventure or nothing. If you follow your passions, in my case, flying in the early days, your life becomes an adventure.
That was Air Force veteran Fred Abrams and his daughter, Amy Schenck, and grandson, Evan. This conversation took place at WISO as part of StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative, which visited the Miami Valley last summer. Veterans Voices on WISO is presented by WrightPat Credit Union with additional support from CareSource. The story was edited by Alan Steiger and Will Davis. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend on WISO. Thanks again for joining us. Today on Dayton Youth Radio, producer Jackson Sawyer and his mom share things they've learned while forming their adoptive family.
My name is Jackson Sawyer. I'm 17 and I'm a senior at Centerville High School. Anyone who is a middle child knows that being the middle child is the worst. I'm never taken seriously when I want to be, and I never get the sympathy I want when I need it. I have five siblings, and I live with my parents. Having five siblings is normal, but my family is even less normal than that, as my three youngest siblings are all adopted. And I hardly get any attention from my parents. I mean, it's hard to pay attention to me with all the trouble that my other siblings get into. Both the oldest of the adopted siblings and my younger sister have been in and out of children's psych wards. The oldest is my brother. We fostered him when he was just a baby. He was born addicted to opioids, He has numerous conditions, including ADHD and reactive attachment disorder. These prevent him from actually being able to have a connection with us. It seems that he's comfortable telling us that he hates us and that he wants to kill us. It can be really scary thinking about my younger brother. The middle of the younger siblings is my youngest brother. His mother was also addicted to drugs, and it cost her her life. He's a very gentle soul at times. He just has a lot of anxiety. The last of the three adopted siblings is my younger sister. She's 5 years old. She has cerebral palsy, and because of that, she wears braces on her legs to help her walk. She constantly throws tantrums over the most minute things. We decided to adopt kids when we realized that our family was really great. We wanted to give a piece of our family that a lot of other kids couldn't have.
Molly Sawyer, and Jackson is my son.
When did you decide that adopting would be better than just fostering?
We had a strong belief that if we were able to provide a safe, loving, stable home, that's what was best.
How has adopting three kids affected you?
Certainly has opened me up to a lot of experiences I had never had in my typical suburban family life.
Would you agree in our household that some kids will just naturally need more attention than others?
Everyone needs quality time where you're present with them. The amount of attention someone needs to help them get dressed in the morning is different than the kind of time that you need as a 17-year-old thinking about going to college and planning your future. Do you think people looking in could ever realize the work that it is to be the sibling of siblings that have needs?
The only way you can really understand any of the kids in our family, you'd have to be them. My youngest sister came to us at a couple of months old. She has 5 older siblings with disabilities. They all live in different homes. We fought for her to have permanency and not to be moved from place to place.
What lessons, maybe as a family, you've learned or as a family we've learned?
I learned that pretty much all babies are just great. So we're like, oh, look at this perfect little angel baby. Oh, it's going to be a perfect little kid. Now we've learned that not all of the younger siblings are perfect.
Well, perfect may be a myth. They've experienced loss and trauma that impact them maybe a lot more than we would have ever realized.
Yeah, because you can't really tell that from a baby.
As they've gotten older, we've learned what that looks like. What lessons will you take with you?
That I don't always get everything I want whenever I want it. Like when now, if I see something that I want, it's almost immediately met with like, oh, I'll never have that. As expected, the house is almost always chaos. Every kid does their own things. My brother and I do marching band. My sister's off in college. The younger two are always in school. And the oldest of the adopted siblings is always doing sports. I hope that the future of our family is a good one, because currently we're in a really rough patch. For Dayton Youth Radio at Centerville, this is Jackson Sawyer.
That was El Medio, written and produced by Jackson Sawyer, a senior at Centerville High School. Special thanks to Trisha Raypock and Molly Sawyer. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basim Blunt.
Great stuff. And you can find more stories like Dayton Youth Radio on our website at wyso.org. Well, the announcement of Cox Media Group's expected sale to private equity firm Apollo Global Management and its holding company, Terrier Communications, has some local lawmakers, community advocates, and media analysts concerned about a decline in local and regional journalism. Among those concerned is Richard Campbell, professor emeritus with the Department of Media, Journalism, and Film at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. In this conversation, Campbell talks about the loss of local news, including his thoughts on the pending sale of Cox Media Group and its effect on the Dayton Daily News and other Cox Media outlets.
This sale is forcing Dayton to become a non-daily. They're invoking an old media ownership rule from the 1970s where a newspaper can't own a TV station or broadcast station in the same market. I mean, this is a 1970s rule when newspapers had kind of a monopoly on classified advertising. So the idea was to try to spread the ownership around, spread the wealth around. Well, we're living in a time now where Facebook and Google are getting 75% of all digital advertising. So this quite doesn't make sense to force the Dayton Daily News to become a three-day-a-week paper. Given the behavior of equity companies in buying newspapers, they usually strip them and fire a bunch of people and try to make them profitable. And if they're not, they just shut them down. And my sense is that Terrier Communication, this is fine with them. I mean, this would allow them to reduce staff. If you're only running a newspaper 3 days a week and not 7 days a week, you can cut a lot of staff, a lot of reporters. This is a bad deal for news in the Dayton area.
And this is actually something you've been concerned with for a long time, the loss of local and regional journalism.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at what's happening, you know, in a recent Brookings Institution study, in stuff that Neiman does, in stuff that the University of North Carolina has been studying, there are 200 counties in the United States now that don't have any newspaper, any kind of news coverage. There are 1,300 news deserts now where communities don't have local news. You know, I think that this is a national problem, but nobody's covering it as a national problem. This is all being handled locally. And on top of this, this is not something that journalism usually covers. They don't cover themselves. This problem, by the way, is so significant. You know, it's a much bigger problem than the impeachment thing going on right now. I mean, that's distracting. And that's totally commanded the national media's attention, while the crisis in local journalism and regional journalism is just, it's just not on anybody's radar at the national level. You know, we've lost 2,000 weekly and daily newspapers in the last 15 years. That's about 20% of all newspapers. There are more TV reporters now than there are daily newspaper reporters. That started happening in 2017.
What would need to happen for this trend to change?
I think, one, the national news has to start covering this as a really serious problem. You know, the only business that was identified by our founders in the Constitution is the press. There was a reason for that. A good democracy needs good journalism. No other business is mentioned in the Constitution. So this, to me, is a national crisis. And these kinds of problems get solved when good journalism is directed at them. So I think that has to happen. I think we have Google and Facebook are doing some initiatives on to try to help local journalism. They're small at this point. But I think a lot more money has to be put into this if we're gonna have the kind of journalism we need to have a good democracy. And I think that places that have journalism programs and universities and colleges have to figure out how to use student journalists more effectively. So that's something that I think could happen as well.
Richard Campbell is Professor Emeritus with the Department of Media, Journalism, and Film at Miami University, Oxford, Ohio. Richard, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And WISO has reached out to Cox Media Group for comment on the pending sale and have been told that they have no comment at this time. However, a Dayton Daily News report previously stated the company's goal is to maintain 7-day publication for the Daily News, Springfield News Sun, and Journal News. We'll keep you posted. In the age of Amazon ebooks and on-demand publishing, small presses have had to make big changes to stay afloat. And Orange Fraser Press in Wilmington has become one of Ohio's most versatile small publishers. Community Voices producer Jason Reynolds stopped by their offices to learn how this little press that could continues to thrive after 30 years.
Main Street in Wilmington, Ohio looks like Main Street in a lot of Midwestern towns. There's a beautiful historic theater from the city's glory days, but there are also a handful of empty storefronts downtown. Make a right and there's a vape shop. Make a left and there's a pawn shop. And if you duck down the alley that runs behind Main Street, you'll stumble upon one of Wilmington's enormous murals. This one looks like a scene from a Shakespeare play. On the second floor of the building, there's a small balcony, and the muralist has painted a woman in a gown on that balcony. She has one hand on the railing and the other on the wall in a way that suggests she's about to climb over, to escape, or elope. These are the offices of Orange Fraser Press and publisher Marcy Hawley.
Most publishers our size don't exist anymore because they haven't been able to make it or they've been purchased by the larger book publishing companies. And we've just stayed independent and we feel like we're rather a hybrid.
By hybrid, Hawley means that Orange Fraser is both a traditional publisher and a custom publisher. They make custom books for big companies and promotional books for arts organizations. They help poets, artists, and children's authors self-publish. The press started out slowly. Marcy Hawley and Orange Fraser editor John Baskin worked at Ohio Magazine in the 1980s. The magazine asked them to make a book of quirky Ohio history. It was called Ohio Matters of Fact, and it included things like the state's history of astonishingly large fruits and vegetables.
In 1842, Isaac Price from Mercer County has a pumpkin 7 feet in circumference which produces 170 pounds of seeds. In 1910,
the magazine's publisher let the book languish, which inspired Hawley and some of her colleagues to take action.
It was our baby, so we bought it back from them, and we put it in the trunks of our cars, and we drove around to all the independent bookstores, and it went into 4 printings. We sold them all.
They started making a book a year and soon left the magazine for publishing. These days, instead of indie bookstores, the internet is the place for a lot of their promotions and sales. And books about sports have become some of their biggest successes.
When Chad Johnson was the wide receiver for the Bengals, that book came out, and we had 2,000 people that came to Main Street. They closed the state routes so everybody could come and sign books with Chad Johnson, and the same with Joe Nuxall. Johnny Bench was here for his book.
Hawley's 2 daughters work with her now. Her daughter, Margaret Morgan, is the first point of contact for most Orange Fraser authors. Oftentimes, writers are looking for a traditional publisher, where the house takes on the risk. But Orange Fraser has had a lot of luck helping people self-publish and build a following.
And a lot of the conversations that I end up having with individuals is explaining the difference between traditional and custom and how difficult it is to get an agent, how difficult it is to get into Big Six publishers. And so we just talk about the possibility of doing a small print run and develop your following, and then you become more attractive to maybe a larger publisher if that's what you ultimately want.
Orange Fraser also makes custom books for corporations and nonprofits. These books might be given away or sold at retail or both. Rick Kennedy wrote the book on GE jet engines. I mean that literally. GE Aviation is celebrating its centennial this year. That wing of GE incorporated in Dayton in 1919. And when they wanted a book to commemorate the anniversary, they asked Kennedy, a 30-year veteran of the company, to write it.
So when I had the opportunity to write this book, I was contracted by GE to write it. There was never any question that I was going to work with Orange Fraser Press because they take these books very personally and they just give them a really charming feel to them, a unique feel. You can always tell an Orange Fraser Press book when you pick one up.
Kennedy says the GE book contains over 200 photos and each one was laid out perfectly. He says that detail and caring is something that Orange Fraser provides from concept to completion.
When you go there to discuss a book with them, you know, Marcy takes you into this like this quaint little dining room area and you sit down on a big couch and chat with her. And, you know, it's very unbusinesslike, brings you a cup of coffee and they, you know, and the different folks are working in little small rooms nearby. And it just, I think, it permeates all the way through the way they conduct business.
And those are the type of personal touches that have kept this small press in the pink. For Culture Couch at WYSO, I'm Jason Reynolds.
Culture Couch is made possible by a generous grant from the Ohio Arts Council. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend.
This is Bill Felger with Poor Will's Almanac for the transition week to early winter, the second week of the silent cricket moon, and the second week of the sun in Sagittarius. Yesterday, the sun reached its earliest setting time throughout much of the country. And when the sun goes down at its earliest time of the year, the second bloom of forsythia flowers typically ends, and witch hazel blossoms wither and the last foliage of the willows and the cypresses and oaks come down. Now the asters, the milkweed, and the boneset, the virgin's bower, the winterberry, the honeysuckle, and the bittersweet set their seeds more quickly. Gauges of passage appear across the land. The osage fruits, decaying, sometimes opened and scattered by squirrels, the hulls of black walnuts, pocked and stained, heaps of leaves darkening, settling, contracting, and dissolving. In the darkest evenings of the year, Lenten roses, however, gradually show their buds as crocus and snowdrops, pierce the soft mulch and hold immune to cold beneath the snow. Sap quivers in the maples every thaw, and the long nights urge the foxes to mate. Prophetic owls lay out their nests. Gauges of a local season are always gauges of a distant season. Knowing home, a watcher measures faraway time. A parochial thermometer not only displays alternating waves of mild or bitter weather, but also counts out the days of the finite winter road, the road that begins in the snow and ends on the warm beaches of summer. This is Bill Felker with Poor World's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the first full week of early winter. In the meantime, be of good cheer. Night comes at its earliest time of all for almost 2 weeks. Then, even though the sun continues to rise later, sunset starts to occur later as well. Even before solstice, spring is on the way.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wyso.org.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Building a more informed community with independent news and storytelling. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Thanks so much for joining us. Up next on WISO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.
Blast off and chill out every Sunday night on Alpha Rhythms. I'm Juliette Frumholt. Join me for ambient, electronic, and new age music that will transport you through space and time. Your week ends and begins Sunday nights from 8 to 11 p.m. with Alpha Rhythms here on 91.3 WYSO.
This is a new and strange environment at first. This suddenly finding yourself in orbit.
This is Lisa Walters from Yellow Springs Brewery. Our business decided to support WISO because we both believe in community. In our tap room at the brewery, we love sharing ideas about current events, and WISO's programming sparks great conversations. And we both believe in independence. WISO's independent model is inspirational to small businesses like us who strive to produce exceptional local options for their customers. Yellow Springs Brewery supports WISO because we are kindred spirits.